Alrighty. Guys, we're actually going to stop this exercise here because there's so many groups of two. So if we could just get the chairs back, let's debrief what happened. And I'm sorry that we didn't get to everybody in the groups of three or in the group of four. I love the buzz. It was amazing feeling the different emotions in each group. We were all in such different places. Yeah, there we go. There we go. So tell me, what was that like?
Painful.
Quiet. Sometimes it's hard to know what to do when you're being boxed in or corralled in to one specific thing. What else was it like? Yes?
I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
People, they actually didn't say anything.
Oh, wow. Now we see why Joe's friends were so successful before they opened their mouths, you know? That was great. I'm glad that was really a good experience. Who else? Any other comments on how this went? So my personality type can read other people's emotions often stronger than I can read my own, or we can read our own. And what was really wild is feeling the different emotions going throughout the groups. We were all over the place. All over the place. But that was really cool. And even when you guys rotated, some groups, the emotional dynamic of that group changed from person to person, which is part of why we do this, because we have to be prepared for that. Any other comments on this experience? It is harder to be the listener than we thought it was, right? So if we think back to that research study that I told you about with the 1500, now you could see why that guy who was the high school guy was absolutely brilliant, right? Somehow he really learned to listen. And somehow he learned to empathize as he was going. And because he couldn't even say, I'm curious about, it, in a sense, it kind of... it let the empathy flow even stronger, and it let other pieces take over that let the clients or the people that were seeing him say, wow, that was great, you know, and even though he had never opened his mouth. So we just want to remember these things as we go, but let's keep moving. So connection is foundational. This is where the heart, you know, the hard work begins always with listening. And so we want to be able to deeply connect with somebody. And if we connect to them, what happens is their heads and their hearts start to align. What often leads us to have a disconnect between our heart and our head is that we're feeling some sort of emotion really intensely that we don't want to feel. So we just shove it down and don't deal with it. But in the process of shoving it down and not dealing with it, we also have to deny it's there, which means we have to cut our head from our heart so we don't feel it. And so oftentimes, just by being connected, what typically happens in many scenarios, as happened with one of the groups here, is that everybody starts feeling what the person speaking is feeling, and then that person feels so safe that they go down to a deeper place and unload. And that's when we know it's really, really powerful. And we'll see an example of that in Scripture in just a second. So kind of nailed all that. So after we do the work of connecting, we can now help them to connect to their heart so they can guard their beliefs. So how do we do that? Let's look at Job 2, 11 through 13 and see the brilliance of Job's friends before they open their mouths. I need to stress that because if not, you all would jump on me because of how many chapters were a problem after they opened their mouths. So 2, 11 through 13. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, Zophar the Naamite. I don't know how to pronounce these. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept. And they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. Powerful three verses. With these three verses, we can practically do an entire course on counseling with just these three verses. What do you see in these three verses that they did?
They went where he was.
They went where he was. They didn't try to pull him out. They didn't say the nice cliche, Romans 8:28, all things worked are good, right? They didn't do that. Right? Yeah, I can't tell you how many of my clients have been really upset at times when people have tried to throw that verse a little too early in the conversation. So, yeah. What else did they do? They went where he was. That was one thing they did. What else did they do? They did what?
Had empathy.
They had empathy. So notice they used the word sympathy and comfort. There's not a Hebrew word for empathy, but a lot of people believe this is the closest we got. This is the closest we got. Because it's beyond, empathy is beyond sympathy, and we'll see that in just a second, and empathy is incredibly comforting, where sympathy typically is not. And we'll see that in just a second. So they really empathize with him. They actually felt what he felt. Do you notice that they did almost the exact same things Job did? Which is pretty freaky. So Job tore his robes, you know, got in the dust. They did almost the exact same thing. What else do you see these three friends did? Towards heaven. So I guess that's a custom of the time that you do dust towards heaven, symbol of worship, symbol of something. I have no idea. One of you is a scholar in the room. Please speak up. Cover me. All right. Next, what else did you see? Yes.
They wept.
So this isn't some passive friendship while you're crying, they're off okay on the other side of the room. They got in there. They let themselves be brokenhearted. They let it happen. And please pay attention to the fact that these are men doing this. Please let's not neglect that for some of us guys that aren't into the touchy-feely side of life. Right? These are men doing this. What else do we notice these three friends did?
They did not speak a word for 7 days.
I could not have like succeeded in that whatsoever. I've got verbal diarrhea. I would have been going nuts, right? But powerful. What stands out to you about not speaking a word for 7 days and seven nights? What does that mean? What were they doing? Sorry?
They sat with him.
So the Hebrew sat with him means similar to what it is in the New Testament when it's abide. I'm going to be right in it with you. I'm going to stay with you. I'm not going to shift you somewhere. I'm going to be the passenger in your car. In a sense, I'm just going to be with you. I'm not going to perform. I'm not going to do anything except be with you. It's an extremely powerful experience when people just be with each other. When I do groups and I have somebody sharing what they feel about something that happened in their life, it's usually really, really awful, really, you know, painful. And they've always kind of been a little disconnected or a lot disconnected from head and heart, so we've seen lots of issues coming up. When everybody in the room stops trying to fix and all they do is be with a person who's feeling everything, powerful. Typically, what we see is something similar to what we see with Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. So obviously not the same as Christ, because he's Christ, but very similar. So in the Garden of Gethsemane, if we put all four accounts of the gospel together, and we kind of put them in chronologically, we see that Christ kept telling the disciples, watch and pray, watch and pray, watch and pray. And then he would go off, start feeling lots of intense things as he's praying to God. He would notice something was off. He would run back to where they were and say, are you still sleeping? Stay with me. Watch and pray. Right? Emphasis. Be with me while I'm feeling this. Then he goes off, says the exact same prayer, Hebrew shortcut for
Same process of feeling it intensely, asking God, etc., etc. Once again, he notices something's off. You're still sleeping. Are you kidding me? Stay with me. And then in one of the accounts, I think it's Luke, it actually says that the disciples fell asleep because of grief. What that means is they tried to stay with him. They tried to feel with Christ, but they were completely so overwhelmed with emotion that they fell asleep. So what was Christ doing? Christ was asking them, don't leave me alone here. This is so overwhelming. He even starts, first thing he says to them when they get there is, my soul is overwhelmed to the point of death. When have the disciples ever heard Christ say something like that? When? The man who's willing to stand in front of all the Pharisees when they're ready to stone him, and he's cool, calm, collected, now he wants to die? What is up? He's begging them, don't leave me alone here. Then what do we see happens in that account? The disciples aren't doing it. So God sends an angel. And what's really powerful, I wish I would have put this up. What's really powerful is if you read the account of the angel, it says that the angel appeared to comfort him. Very next sentence. And Christ's grief became so intense that he started sweating blood. Sounds like the angel failed. Or did it? What in essence happened was, is the angel connected to him so that they were together. And what I see happens in groups is when somebody feels that connection, they actually descend into a deeper place. And what starts happening is they start being so incredibly real. So incredibly real as to what's going on. They start seeing it, and it's usually almost alarming, like what they're going through, because they feel so safe now that there's somebody else with them in it, that they can now see what's going on in their heart. And what's going on in their heart is so dark, and it's so horrible, but it's real. Then what do we see with Christ? Christ goes from sweating blood, goes back to the disciples, says, you're still sleeping? Notices Judas coming. The next phrase is powerful. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. Weren't you just sweating blood, wanting to avoid all this? And now you're trying to charge into it? What happened? How do you go from sweating blood to let's go, charge? The only way you do that is you get connected. You get in it with other people. You remember, hey, this is what I was called to do. I'm called to die here. I'm fulfilling what God wants. This is good. Let's go. Right? Most of us need connection so that we can get strength. So the circumstance for Christ didn't change, but the way he saw it changed. He was no longer sweating blood. He was able to stand in it firm, move forward. Let's go. Make sense? Any questions on that? Because I'm totally going to build on this. We good? All right. Let's look at it. So, there's a principle that I like to share with people that helps you think out how to really help somebody. And we call it the JAR principle, where the J stands for join, the A stands for advice or being authentic, the R stands for risk. And basically what the JAR principle says is that before you risk giving advice, you must join the other person first. So let's talk about what joining means. Joining is the process of using empathy and listening to understand someone else's perception and beliefs. So it's all about, I'm going to prove to you that I see what you're seeing. And I'm not going to say a word of advice to you until I prove it. When you say to me, yes, that's how I see things, now we're joined. Now we're connected. Because usually you sense somebody feels like they're no longer alone. You kind of get excited. It's like, let's go. Let's solve this. This is whatever's going on. Joining also means that you're in a non-judgmental position. So after listening intently and reflecting back what you're hearing them say, all the while
So in other words, as you're listening carefully, typically what we're doing is we're kind of either repeating back what they're hearing, what we're hearing them say, or paraphrasing what they're saying so that they know that they're tracking, that we're tracking with them. And then, you know, you're still letting yourself feel, you're still tracking it. When you can kind of summarize it in a statement, like saying, John, what I'm hearing you are believing is X. And then you always want to add the phrase, am I off? That question will save you a ton of time. Because if you just say, John, I think you're believing X, and John disagrees with you, the unfortunate thing is typically what John feels is, you haven't heard a word I said. Now I'm discouraged. But if you say, am I off? John gets excited. Because even if you're off, he's saying, oh, but you're trying. That's cool. I just need you to try. And the am I off shows me that you're trying. And so let me correct it. No, it's not quite X. It's more like this. And now we're still together. We can keep moving. You want to hear the other person say, yes, you got it. And then you know that you're joined. So obviously, this is a process. It takes practice. You don't have to nail it. You just have to attempt. The good news is you don't have to be perfect at spotting the beliefs. You don't have to be perfect at listening to understand. You don't have to be perfect at empathy. Most of us, when we just get a taste of it, that you're doing it with us, we feel so incredibly encouraged and we move forward. Any questions so far before I jump higher? All right. So let's talk about what joining is not. Joining is not agreement. So very often you're going to hear people say things that you just, you know it's wrong. It's not true. But joining is essential for them to hear your perception. So you want to join first. Joining is not validating that what they believe is true. If I said the sky outside is green with pink polka dots and I'm upset about it, I hope you don't say, Ryan, I see blue with white clouds. I'll feel disconnected from you. I'm not going to ever get there. Join my feeling of frustration, and then you'll see me come around to see the sky is blue with white clouds in the air. Okay? And joining is not forgetting how you see things. It's cool that you see it differently than the other person. That's great. That's human. That's not a problem. All you're doing is proving to them, I see it the way you do. That's all you're doing. This is how you see it, right? I got how you got it? Great. That's all we're doing with joining. And you never want to move forward with advice until you've proven that. Typically, the advice is not received, understood, or willing to act on until they know that you see things the way they do. Not that you agree with it, not that you, whatever, they need to know that you get them. Now they're more open to hear. And if anything, what they feel is grateful that you see it. We good with all that? Any questions? Because I'm throwing 15 years worth of work in like a very sandwich. Are we okay? Yes.
Do you have any advice for if someone wants to share what they feel but can't speak it?
Yes, we're getting there. Yeah, whole section on that. Because most of us can't. Yes, sir.
What if the person, when you're trying to join with them, takes what you're saying or how you're relating and sees it as valid?
Yes. Perfect. Great question. I was hoping that was going to come up because I forgot to put it in the slide. So thank you for saying that. So it does happen sometimes that I'm joining someone. So let's take the guy that I was telling you about that was just having serial affairs, right? So he had so many affairs that literally one time in a session when he came in, he came in all of it excited. So it's if you picture me sitting here, he's sitting right where Aaron is. She's sitting, not holding hands at all, because she was really angry at him. She's sitting probably like closer to this chair right over here, right? It's a sofa, right? And I'm sitting just about here. So this guy's been having serial affairs, marriage is on the brink of divorce. It's just awful, right? And he claims he's a believer, and there's all sorts of weird dynamics going on. I mean, he's just so lost in his sin, right? And he's saying all these things. He also travels a lot for business, so it's really easy for him to have affairs, you know, because he's in a different city, all sorts of things like that. Now picture this couple being them with her sitting there. He says, Ryan, I've got exciting news. And he looks at his wife like, this is good, right? And I'm like thinking, good, we're getting there. He's seeing something. And he says, get this,
he says, I only had four affairs this week. And he's excited. Guess where she was? Guess where I was? I was infuriated. Because it was so obvious that he wasn't paying attention to her. She's crushed. She actually got excited because she's been hoping and wanting change so bad because she loves this guy. She gave her heart to him. They've been married for 30-something years. This isn't like a yesterday marriage. I mean, they did life together, right? They were in their 50s. They got married young. She froze. And it was one of those freezes where therapists get nervous. Because what it signals is she's trying to become indifferent. Because she can't take the pain anymore. So she doesn't want to feel. And if she doesn't want to feel, we're in trouble. Head-heart disconnect is going to be alive and well. And frankly, I'd rather have him as the client than the indifferent. Because once somebody fully goes indifferent, you can't push a reward to encourage change. You can't push a punishment to kind of move change. You're stuck because they don't care. So for me, I now have to control my emotions. I'm angry and he's excited. Like we should all be doing high fives and celebrating. That's tough, right? I still need to join what he feels. Why? Because that's ultimately what's going to change the perception. So what do you do? Instead of saying, I agree with you, that's a great thing to celebrate, which I can't go with, right? Instead it's, I can see why you would feel really excited about that. That's a big change for you. You notice the difference? I'm not trying to validate that that was a good thing. And then you jump to the next thing. How do you feel? What are you sensing from your wife right now? And he looked over with joy, happy. And then he looks at her, and she just kind of looks at him, deadpan. And he looks back at me, and it's the first time he stopped being happy. And he said, I don't know what she's feeling. I said, exactly. What does that tell you? So now we can start joining her. And through the process of joining each one of them, without me saying, how dare you say, whatever, you know, correct to be the dad, or whatever you want to call me, by helping him expose and join what each person's feeling, now we can do some transition work. And so the next question was, where are you with this? And she said, Ryan, I'm out. I'm done. I can't do this. I feel crushed. And then as she started to describe it, boom, she started to feel and started to cry profusely. That's where I went. So it got loud in my office. Everybody knew what we were talking about that day in my office, right, at that point. But I was like, oh, yes, we're feeling again. This is so much better than freeze. We can do something. She can now heal. While she's frozen, she's not going to heal. It's just not going to happen. Make sense? You always join, but you're not validating. You're just saying, I see how you see this. You see this as a celebration. But not there. Make sense? All right. So once we connect, we got to jump into empathy. And so there's a video that I showed the men's breakfast on empathy that I think is perfect to describe empathy. It has some funny parts. It's okay to laugh in certain sections. Don't feel bad at that. And it does a really good job at saying what empathy is, and it does a really good job at saying what sympathy is. And what I want us to do is I want us to pay attention. What's the difference between sympathy and empathy? Can I ask you to do your magic? I don't know how many of you have seen this video, but it's a good one. What'd you get from that? It is good. What did you all get from it? What did you learn? What stood out to you? You have to do what Job's friends did.
Get in it. What else do you notice? What else stands out? It takes time. Effort. Yeah. So most of us would find it hard to sacrifice 7 days and seven nights. Unfortunately, we usually don't have to do that in order to help somebody. But we do need to get in there, and we have to know that it's going to be a process. They need to know that we're in it with them for a little while. Yeah. Oh, my goodness, yes. I've done a fair amount of grief counseling, and one of the things that's been really hard from gospel-centered believers that I hear them say, that usually when they get to my office after the funeral and the death, one of the top things that I hear is, I am so angry at the way people wouldn't let me feel. They kept trying to make it good. And it's not. And usually what, you know, they have to smile, right? Because it's the husband, it's the wife, it's, you know, whoever it is that just died. But inside they're like, how dare you? Because what they didn't realize is when we throw out the cliches too fast, it's as if we're saying, don't feel what you feel. Don't feel it. You need to feel X. If you were really spiritual, you would know Romans 8:28 is true. Go to Romans 8:28. If Jesus can sweat blood, I think we can feel what we feel and be okay. That's me, but I do think that. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
And it seems like that when you're trying to empathize, you want to know how they feel.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's impossible.
Right.
To even begin to understand how you feel.
So if two people went through the exact same experience, you still don't know what they feel. You still don't. Because we filter everything that we go through according to our history and according to how we perceived it in the moment. Four people can go through the same car accident. Two are traumatized, two are not. I've got clients who were sexually abused. Most were absolutely traumatized. Some were not. And you would think everybody should be. It's not the way it works. We're human. We don't know exactly what somebody else feels, but we can move towards feeling it with them. And so long as we're in the range, that's where empathy kicks in, which is why it's valuable. So when she said the statement, I don't even know what to say, golden. Because it lets the person know, I'm getting in there with you, but you and I both know that I can't feel this the way you do. And that's okay. But I'm still going to get close. I'm going to fight to get there because I'm going to stay with you. That's powerful. Yes? Mm-hmm.
You don't understand.
You don't.
So don't say that when you're interacting with people. And the second part is, if you need to get to a point where you can empathize with someone, going to your own experiences, don't always share.
That's exactly right.
Then you make it about yourself.
That's it.
And not about that person. And
yep.
It takes over the whole problem.
So yeah.
Sometimes if you need to get that emotion, that's fine, but it's better just to sit there with that person, listening to them.
You just said the next part of my section, which is awesome. Which is absolutely awesome. Let's get there. Let me just jump forward. Has everybody said all this? Let me set that up. Okay, it's coming in just a little bit. Let me say one thing and then connect back to what you just said, and then we'll keep going. So one thing that I want you to understand, and if you look at Scripture, look for anybody that needed healing. And what you'll always see is that people were always involved in the healing process. It's really hard to find an example of God healing somebody without using somebody else in some way, shape, or form. The closest we get is Nebuchadnezzar, but even then, he had attendants that were around. So God always uses people. He wants us to participate in everything he's doing, just like he's restoring the earth and redeeming it. He's going to use us to do the same thing in people's lives. And so just always remember that. So change actually happens through relationship. When the key is to always help them to no longer feel alone. Once they no longer feel alone in their pain, the healing is then starting to activate. So I might as well go back and talk about it. So just think about Adam before Eve. So Adam before Eve, no shame, no guilt. None.
No regret. None of those negative emotions. I mean, that must have been amazing, right? He gets to walk and talk with God, like you and I are talking. That's cool, right? He gets this incredible, incredible garden to work, and the work was great. He gets to name all the animals. I have some animals that are a blast to be with. I can only imagine what, in a redeemed state, animals must have been like back then, right? So he's having a lot of fun. I always jokingly say the weather must have been great because he was naked. So even he had great weather, too, on top of everything, right? He gets all this good stuff. Yet Scripture says that he was alone. Now, that's fascinating. How can you be with God and still be alone? That's pretty interesting. How can life be ideal and still be alone? That's pretty freaky. If you look up the Hebrew word alone, what it says, the word alone in Hebrew means he was moving into darker and darker areas of depression. And what typically happens to any of us is that the longer we're alone, even the most introverted of us, the longer we're alone, we start going down the mental disorders. So we start with depression, then often we start hearing things or seeing things, and things start to really break down, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. So we kind of become like Tom Hanks in Castaway, or for the women in the room, the crazy cat woman, you know, who's got like 47 cats in her house and you know isolates herself. That's what happens when we're alone. What this means is that when we're not in heart-to-heart connection, we're actually de-evolving, which means we're getting worse. So if we want to heal, we need to be in heart-to-heart connection, and then we can actually heal. And the reason for that is because God made us in his image. So what's his image? His image is actually a relationship. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and deep intimacy with one another. If we don't do the same, we don't work. Make sense? All right. So I'm going to skip this clip and just keep going. So let's see what happens. So as I said to you guys, when somebody finally gets joined, when somebody feels the connection, typically they descend into a deeper place and get so real because they're finally connected to their heart and they see what's going on. So let's now see this with Job. In your handout, so Karen did an awesome job making copies and having folders for all of us. I'm very grateful she did, and if she was here, I would have you all applaud and all that because she more than deserves it, especially because I got them late to her. So if we could turn to the section that has Job 3 printed in the handout. So I think it's in this section on the second page. Now, let me set this up for us. I want you to imagine you're Job's friends. I want you to imagine that Job is a really good friend of yours, really good friend. So for you to take a week out of your life plus travel time, good friend, right? So I want you to really put yourself in those shoes. You have been feeling agony, absolute agony, for 7 days and seven nights. You've been feeling Job's agony for 7 days and seven nights. And now Job speaks for the first time. What I want you to think of while somebody reads this is, what would I be feeling if someone I love deeply is saying these words? What would I be experiencing? So if you have to substitute somebody else that you love deeply, or even substitute an animal that you love deeply, whatever it is that pulls you in there, we need you in there, because I'm hoping to help us understand why things went so south. So I'd like for somebody, so that I'm not talking all the time, to read Job chapter 3. Could somebody stand up in nice big voice and read it for us? Thank you, Arnie. Beautiful. Thank you, Arnie. So talk to me, guys. You're close, someone you deeply love just said this to you. What are you feeling?
I would say he was an excellent speaker.
Yeah, so for sure he's an excellent speaker.
I'd be worried.
Yeah, so notice worry is one thing you would be feeling, right? All of a sudden it's like, this guy really wants to die. And I love him. Like he's in suicide mode. Like, let's keep the swords away kind of mode. Or in the modern day, the guns away or whatever. Right? You feel helpless. Talk more about that. That's it. Yeah. How in the world do I help somebody who's there? Usually we start to feel pretty overwhelmed. The closer somebody is to us, the harder it is for us to enter pain like this. Because our hearts are so involved. Time to call a therapist. Referral. Yeah, it's hard for us to stay in it.
Yeah.
What else would you be feeling?
There's absolute darkness.
Darkness.
There's no light at all.
No light. If you're really being empathetic, you're going to enter that space with them. So you may not have been suicidal, but now you're going to get why somebody could be suicidal.
That to me, as like somebody that has not really ever felt that way, that is a scary place.
That's a very scary place. That's exactly right.
If I were alongside with somebody like that, I would feel like that's going to almost drag me down.
Yes.
Like when you hear about the actors who become so immersed in their character.
Yes.
Yes. That's where I
yes. Thank you for saying that. The closer they are to you, the more afraid you're going to be to go there with you. So what I say to couples all the time, is if a complete stranger insults you in a specific way, and your spouse insults you in the exact same way, the complete stranger, you forgive and forget and you move on fairly quickly. The spouse, you recycle that sucker over and over again and hammer it onto them for years and years and years. You don't get over that one easy. Why? I'm vulnerable to my spouse. I gave her my heart. There's nothing left for me to give. And she does that? Painful. I didn't do that with a stranger. What winds up happening is the closer we are to someone, we have to be really careful when we're entering into helping them. Because every instinct in us wants to stop the pain because it's overwhelming us. It's not about them anymore. It's about us. So there's, as I share this with the men's group, there's been twice in my marriage, Grace used to do the phones for me, so she used to hear clients and she would hear comments from clients and she would hear about the groups and different things like that. There's been twice in my marriage where Grace was sharing something completely dark, really painful, overwhelming. I'm empathetic, so I feel it, and I'm feeling it intensely. Twice in my marriage, she has said to me, Ryan, and this is after me screwing it up so many times, trying to stop her feeling it, trying to doing all the wrong things. She's literally turned to me twice and said, Ryan, right now, I wish I was one of your clients. Yeah, that was one of those, give me a minute, let me transition, and then I have to transition. Why? I love that woman. I don't want to see her go through that. So whenever we're trying to help somebody, I'm not saying that we can't help those that are closest to us. I think we can. I think we can actually do a brilliant job with those, like our kids, our wives, our husbands. I think we can do a brilliant job with them. We have to use a lot more emotional self-control and stay with them. Because in actuality, the closer you are to the person, the more healing they can receive through this exchange because of the closeness. So if you guys compliment me, that's at one level. If Grace compliments me in the same way, wow, she knows all my stuff. So if she's saying it, that's pretty cool. It works in reverse, in other words. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's keep going. So let's look at Job chapter 3, so still keep it out. Tell me, this is the first time Job is speaking to his friends. What does he do? What does Job do? He pours his heart out. Do you see how he pours his heart out? He's cursing the day he was born. So I want you to notice something. Job doesn't do what most of us would probably do. If we went through an experience like this, I don't know about you, but I would start with the facts. First this happened, then that, then I lost my kids. Then, you know, a servant kept showing up, and it was awful. And then all of a sudden I got these boils. And then my wife, oh my goodness, my wife says, curse God and die. Can you believe she said that? Right? We're just fact, while I'm feeling something intensely. Human beings, when we experience somebody having lots of emotion, but they're saying lots of facts, what human beings do is we start to analyze the facts to see if they should feel what they feel. That's what we do. So now we become little judgers. Should you really be feeling that? Let me see. What's that fact? There's no connection there. I'm not being empathetic. I'm evaluating. I'm using my head, not my heart then. If we want to help somebody connect to us, or if we want them to do a better job to help us connect to them, we have to do what Job does. Job doesn't give a single fact. Do you notice in all this chapter, there is not one fact that Job goes to? Not one. Not one. And it's the first time he's speaking. What does he do? He shares what he feels. And he actually describes it extremely well. If you notice, when he describes what he feels, he gives lots of metaphors. A lot of metaphors. It's like a painting's worth 1,000 words. Metaphors are similar. By painting the picture of what I feel, you actually start to experience it more. He also uses, even though he doesn't say the word agony, it's obvious he's feeling agony as the dominant emotion. He uses other emotions interspersed that also describe his state of being. And the last thing he also does is he also, a little bit, but does more later, describe what he's physically experiencing while this emotion is going through him. Why does Job spend all this chapter, and let me add to that, why does paper and ink, expensive paper and ink, get used to have a whole long chapter with just metaphors? What's God trying to impress on us? What are some thoughts? This is important. This is the oldest book in Scripture, and God has this level of details on what Job says. I think we need to be paying attention. The whole idea is if we want people to connect to our heart, we have to describe what we're feeling, and we have to stay away from the facts. If we use facts, they start to evaluate. They don't connect. If we use a description of what we feel, now it's like being pregnant. Are you pregnant? Are you not pregnant? I can't judge what you feel. You feel it. There's nothing to analyze. You say you're in agony, you must be in agony. I have nothing to evaluate it with. I get pulled towards your heart. So now if you're a really good friend and he's using a technique which we call MOP, metaphors, other emotions, physical sensations, and you're being pulled in to where he's feeling and starting to feel something you've never felt before, right? So I remember my first client that was suicidal. I'd never been suicidal in my life. And they are live right in the room, suicidal, describing what they feel. I thought I was going to lose my mind. I have never heard pain like that before. I've been through a lot of pain in my life. I've experienced hard things. But to that point, I don't know that I've ever gone that dark. And they're a believer. So I was like, well, I don't even have the excuse that they're a non-Christian, right? Or something like that, where they don't have hope. They got the gospel. What this means is that we want to do the same thing. We want to encourage those that we're helping to do the same thing. Describe what you feel, and I'll really connect to you. If you tell me the facts, I have to work harder to connect to you because I have to stop my brain from analyzing. See that? All right, let's move on. So I have this little ditty that I say to clients all the time. In order to heal, you have to get real and feel. And that's what empathy does. It allows that to happen. And so one of the things that we really want to do is we want to practice what's known as emotional recall. What emotional recall is remembering something in the past that you felt to such detail that you start feeling it in the present. So I'll give you a fast example of this. Please, right now, I want you to think back to a time when you were cracking up hysterically with laughter. Think back to a time when you were cracking up like crazy with laughter. Give yourself the details silently. I wish you guys were where I'm standing. I just did 5 seconds of it. Your faces went from where they were to full smiles. Some of you are holding back laughter. It's a cool thing to see. Notice what she especially said is so true. If you want to be empathetic with someone, all you have to do is remember a time in your life that you felt something similar to them and start to tell the story in your head as they're talking. And you will find yourself moving towards that emotion. And what that does for the person who's talking is they now feel really valued. Yeah, you get me. Thank you. And that starts the healing process. Make sense? You good? I'm moving really fast. All right, so you want to listen for the key emotion. You want to remember. You want to silently remember when you felt something similar. You want to kind of practice with some dominant emotion. So if you guys look inside the folder, there's something that's called a feelings chart. When I first learned about feelings, I hated feelings. I was probably your typical guy in that way. I was like, you want me to describe what I feel? Oh my goodness, are you serious? And it's like I was one of those people, right? And now I get feelings charts out all the time, right? So it's like obviously I learned something in the process. So the feelings chart on the front page of it has some dominant emotions. One thing, if you're going to start helping people, is you want to practice by first looking at each of those dominant emotions and remembering a time in your life where you felt it. And you want to practice feeling it in the present. So if you really want to mess with your mind a little bit, you could literally start going through each of those emotions and you'll start noticing your emotions shift. I was happy. No, now I'm sad. Now I'm this. And it's kind of like you can ping pong all around the place just by remembering times. But the more you do this practice, even though it messes with your mind and you go back and forth, it's going to make you so empathetic. It's going to make you so empathetic. The second your friend starts talking about a time that they were angry, the story's going to pop up and you're going to be right there. And what they need is they need to know you're in it. And so this is the biggest way to know that you're in it. So it's a fast empathy tool. Once again, you're not going to tell them your story. Oh, this is just like when I was going through. Right? How many times have we had people do that and we were trying to share something and now the conversation shifts all that to that other direction where we get lost in the shuffle? Right? That's like one of the worst things that we could do, and I'm very guilty of doing it sometimes. We want to resist that. It's silent. Silent. On my own, I start thinking about it until I get there. And then when you sense that your emotion's there, don't be surprised if you actually sense the connection at the same time. It's usually a very powerful thing. All right. So let's move forward. I'm going to show you guys how to do this MOP technique. This is something that you're going to have to practice, and we're going to do a little exercise with it right now, with you personally. And so one thing you've got to get good at is you've got to get good at describing what you feel. And if you could do it closer to Job, you're going to realize that people are going to be much more drawn to you, much more naturally. And you're going to sense that if you're in trouble, if you're hurting, if something like that, a friend wants to help, it's going to help them to help you a lot faster. So the technique works both ways. So one of the ways that I teach my clients to do this is typically when I teach them about mopping, I have them look down first. For me, I was somebody who had a lot of trauma in my life, so I did not want to feel. Because I was... Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell us again what mop is?
Yes. So it's metaphors. Oh, I thought it was on this page. Metaphors, other emotions, and physical sensations. So what's your body experiencing while you're feeling the emotion? It's on the last page. Thank you. Yep, that's okay. I should have reversed the order. So what when I'm teaching somebody to learn how to do this technique, what I ask them to do is that I ask them to send me an email where they are to put on the subject line of the email what the dominant emotion is, so whatever the emotion is on the front of the page. And then when I open up the email, I should see them write an M for metaphor, and then they give me a metaphor. Then I ask them to give me O and to go into the feelings chart in the section under where the dominant emotion is and to choose some of the emotions from there. And because we're also human, we're typically not just stuck in one category. Typically, we have a couple things from some other category, so whatever's there is there. And then I ask them to stop what they're doing and give me what their body's experiencing as this emotion's going through them. Now, some of you, I see that they changed the adjusted the temperature, but what often happens when I have women do these MOPS and they send me the email, it does not matter what the dominant emotion is. One of the physical sensations is always, I'm cold. And it's because they're usually in an air-conditioned building where the AC is on too high. So they could be angry, happy, sad. It always physically, I feel cold. You know, so it's like, okay, that's just AC. But it's okay that we kind of even get that out because that helps a ton too. Because we need to get good at this technique. So here's how I do this, and here's how I learned how to do this, because my therapist, when he was trying to get me to learn how to feel, he was so frustrated with me. I mean, I can't believe the man didn't fire me. He was so frustrated trying to teach me how to feel that he used to point to the part in his hair where there was gray coming in, and he'd say, see all this gray, Ryan? This is you. This is me trying to teach you how to feel. That's what that is. I used to be like, oh, great. He sometimes would tell me, I need to charge you double because of how much work I'm doing to try to get you to feel. So this is how I learned how to feel, and now I feel all the time, which is great because I also do a lot of healing, which is another story. And hopefully this will help you. So the first thing is that you do is you look down the front page of the feelings chart and identify what your dominant emotion is. When I first started this, I couldn't identify even my dominant emotion. So what I had to start with is I had to say what it wasn't. Well, I'm not this, and I'm not that, and I'm not the other. Oh, yeah, I'm probably this one. This one's kind of closer to where I am. So if you have to do it that way, great. Then typically when we have a dominant emotion, an image comes to our head. So when I was doing this for the men's breakfast with pornography, and I was trying to write this slide out, the image that popped, my kids and I were watching like a bunch of Looney Tunes the night before. And so the image that came to my head was there was this like really fat blonde kid licking a lollipop that was just absolutely like happy in, you know, licking the lollipop in Looney Tunes. So that was my metaphor. I just have to word the word like to the whatever image came to my head. I'm happy like the fat blonde kid in Looney Tunes licking the lollipop. That works. Next, you go into the happy section on the feelings chart and you pull out what some of the words were from that lists that are really you. So jolly, effusive, elated, energized. As I said, sometimes, usually when, because you're human, that there's other emotions from other columns. So I also was feeling satisfied and content. And then at that point, you stop what you're doing and now pay attention to your body. Where's your body while this emotion's going to you? And at the time that I did this, I said that my blood feels slightly warm. My heart's beating slightly faster than normal. My breathing slightly faster than normal. And I'm grinning ear to ear. And then you put it all together, and that gives you a MOP. I'm happy. Like the fat blonde kid in a Looney Tune cartoon who was licking his lollipop, I feel jolly, effusive, elated, energized, satisfied, content. My blood feels slightly warm. My heart is beating slightly faster than normal, breathing slightly faster than normal. I'm grinning from ear to ear. Now, why are we doing this? We're doing this, once again, because we have to train people to not analyze the facts. We need them to connect to the heart. So the cool thing about this process is when you connect to the heart, you can also usually sense what the facts are that are around it. So some of you in the men's group heard me do this, so you're not allowed to answer this one. This is only the only people I want to participate in this live action, can you connect to my heart and read what was going on exercises, anybody who has not heard me do this. And so those who have heard me can verify that what the conclusion is true. So I'm going to give you one of my clients' MOPS, and I want you to tell me what happened to her. So I'm going to give you a MOP that she sent me. I'm not going to give you any facts. And I want you to tell me what happened to her. Okay? So let's try it. Only people who can participate are those who have not heard this before. Yes, what happened to make her, to let her feel that way. So I showed this to a client in session about 2 hours or so after that. I always have my clients send me mops over email, and then I can see if they're doing anything that's outside the mop and help show them that so they can get really good at this process. So she goes off, and 2 hours after the meeting, she sends me her first mop. On the subject line, it says, "I'm angry." So notice, I can't connect to that anger yet. As I said in the men's group, we don't know what range that anger's in. We don't know if it's a low anger, like a mosquito buzzing around your ear, kind of annoyance kind of anger. Or on the upper end, we don't know if she's ready to take over a small country. Right? So we don't know where she is yet. So I can't connect to it yet. So I open up the email. First thing I read, M hyphen. I feel like a phoenix that's burning everything in its path. Woman's taking over the country. Yeah? Oh, I feel infuriated and enraged, very hurt and utterly betrayed. P, I feel my blood getting warm. I can hear my heart pounding in my ear. My fists are starting to clench. My teeth are starting to grind. And my eyes are filling up with tears. Now, let me give it to you all together. You tell me what happened to her. I'm angry, like a phoenix burning everything in its path. I'm infuriated and enraged, very hurt and utterly betrayed. I feel my blood getting warm. I hear my heart pounding in my ear. My fists are starting to clench. My teeth are starting to grind. And my eyes are filling up with tears. What happened to her? What happened? Yes. Notice I never said husband. I never said her age. I never said anything about her. Her husband, she just found out that her husband cheated on her. How on earth would you put that together from the emotions? I didn't say the facts. What happens is the more you hone in on the heart has an ability to read. And suddenly things start to make sense. But I've also eliminated my bias because I didn't give any facts. And so typically you're pulled in. So even people that tell me they struggle to feel can often get in the neighborhood. What sounds like a betrayal, you know, or they say something like that. The idea is we want to do this because it actually really works and it really helps out a lot. So I want you guys to do this for yourself, to try this once. We're just going to take 10 minutes to do this. And I'd like you to go to page 5. And I want you to have your feelings chart out and go through the 7 points. And let's do it in under 10 minutes. So first start with, what am I feeling right now? And you can identify it from the front of the feelings chart. And then just keep going through. Right now, at this moment in time. At this moment in time, what are you feeling right now?
Does hunger have me?
I don't think hunger's an emotion there, but I think sometimes it could be and should be. You cannot create an emotion. So you feel what you feel.
No, I mean, if you're hungry, you could create it. An emotion could be created.
That's right. Because I'm hungry, I feel frustrated. Because I'm hungry, I feel whatever. Don't try to wordsmith. Just do what first pops in your head.
Do you have any more videos?
No, I'm not going to show any more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Have fun.
And I get that at first this is awkward and weird and a little tough, but trust me, clients are often shocked that they hear people mopping all the time, especially men when they're watching football. Amazing thing when college football is around, how much mopping gets done. All right. I'm just going to move us along just because of time, because I have something intense that I have to do with you guys, and I need to make sure there's room for the intense moment. So let's talk about what you've learned so far as the steps as to really help people. So far, you learned that you yourself have to get centered on the gospel. You got to remember that your goal is to connect first and foremost. Without connection, nothing else happens. The next thing is you need to be non-judgmental, and you do that by turning on your curiosity. Next comes in empathizing. Next, it's encouraging them to mop. So you could just say something like, I'm hearing lots of facts, and I don't know how to take the facts. And you just tell me really what you're feeling. I can connect to that. That I can really get. You really want to listen to understand. And one thing that I didn't mention, or I mentioned it in passing, that let me say that every once in a while, somebody's talking, just repeat back what you're hearing them say every once in a while. Please don't sound like a therapist that's doing it all the time or something like that. Every once in a while, pepper back, I'm hearing you say X. Am I off? You can always use the am I off, because that's going to save a lot. And in the process of repeating back and listening to them, they're going to start kind of drilling down and drilling down, and then you want to listen for a belief statement. The way you know you've hit a belief statement is it's an always or nothing statement. And often I know that we really hit the belief statement because my client wants to correct it. Oh, wait, Ryan, it's not quite like that. I mean, it's not that bad. It's more like this. Usually I know, oh, yeah, it's that. Let's go back. You know, let's stay right there. We're good. You know, and I do things like that. I say things like that. Often these belief statements are really kind of messed up, you know, so we don't want to admit that we have them in particular because it doesn't make us look all that good sometimes. And often we know that we've hit it because it's usually partly true and it has a twist component to it. So some clients will say to me things like, it's really ridiculous that I believe this, but here it is. And then they'll make the statement. Sometimes the belief statement just pops out of nowhere. She never listens to me. Well, you know, and if she wanted to be a little smart aleck and she said, you know, that, oh, I never listened to you, never, ever, look out. It's about to get really intense and hot in that room, you know, if you try to do that. But the person's in essence saying, this is what my heart believes. She doesn't listen to me. That's what I'm believing. You know, and we once again want to help the person say that we see their perception. So you believe that she never listens to you. Yes, I do believe that. Great. Let's keep on. All right. When do we get the handouts?
Yeah.
I'm going to email I think they're going to just put the PowerPoint slides on the church website, or I'll email it out to you guys. Either way. So at the end, I'll have a piece of paper where you guys can write your name and fill it out. Actually, if somebody has, can you take a piece of paper and just write name and email address, and then we'll send it around and I'll email you the PowerPoint slides to make sure that you guys get it, and I'll do that later today. So let's talk about what not to do, okay? So far, you know, I'm trying to help you guys get contained and really listening to understand and being empathetic. There's a lot that can go wrong in this process, and we have a great example of it in Job. So I want us to read, just for the sake of time, we're going to shorten this. Does somebody have a Bible with them? And if they can just go to Job chapter 4, and I need somebody with a strong voice. Wade, you want to do it? Strong voice to read. And I'm going to interrupt you sometimes, so please don't get thrown off by that, because I'm doing it for a reason. So Job chapter 4, we're not going to do 5, just part of 4. Go for it.
All right. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, if one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking?
Stop. Stop right there. Notice that phrase. Who can keep from speaking? All right? So Job just poured out his heart. That was intense. That was dark. That was scary. I can't be quiet now. That was incredible. Keep going. Stop. What's he doing?
You're wrong to feel
that. Yes. Notice all the judging. You're wrong. Notice. He's even, in a sense, calling Job a hypocrite. Didn't you do this for so-and-so? Why aren't you doing this now for you? You just poured out your heart to your friends, and you're starting to hear this. Keep going.
Remember who that was innocent ever perished, or where were the upright cut off?
Stop. Now what's he saying?
It's all your fault.
It's all your fault. Now we know why this happened, right? We know this has nothing to do with Job's performance. We know this is all about a conversation between Job and Satan. So you just poured out your heart to someone. You just finished, like, deep down, doesn't get any deeper, heart. You're as vulnerable as you can be. And you get judged. And then you get told, did it all wrong. You're doing it all wrong. You're wrong. Keep going.
As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble will reap the same. By the breath of God they perish. And by the blast of his anger they are consumed. The roar of the lion...
Stop right there. So now what's he doing? Who's he bringing into this? Yeah, how's he bringing God into this conversation? God's going to get you. God's going to get you. You just poured out your heart to somebody. You're as vulnerable as you can be. You're being judged left and right. You're being told you're wrong. And now God's after you. Keep going, please. Stop. What's he doing now? Yeah. Listen to me. I can fix you. I got you, babe. I can do this. I got you. And I got this secret knowledge going on. Go ahead.
When deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence, then I heard a voice. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust, and his angels he charges with error. How much more those who dwell in the house of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed like the moth. Between morning and evening they are eaten to pieces. They perish forever without anyone regarding it.
Let's stop right there. That's perfect. You got to feel for it, right? This goes on for two chapters. Two long chapters. Long chapters. I don't know about you, but if I just poured my heart out to somebody and they come back with this, New York is going to show up sometime here, right? It's going to show up. So, let's look at it. What did Eliphaz do? You can repeat some of the things that I did. What did Eliphaz do? He passed judgment. What else did he do? He blamed Job. What else did he do?
He excused himself.
He excused him. I'm righteous. If only you could be like me. I'm the most modest man I know. What else did he do? He painted a horrible picture of God. God's the God who's going to get you. Stepped out of line, whack. That's scary, because I'm stepping out of line left and right. Get a feel for it? So let's break it down. Eliphaz did what I call, or what we came up with as the acronym JAC, or Jack, which is he judged, or justified. He justified himself, judged. He gave advice. He made accusations. He also corrected facts, or even started to use facts. Once again, if we're using facts, we're shifting away from our heart back to our head. Now, notice how natural it is for us to do any of these things. And please don't leave me alone in this. I'm sure I'm not the only one who at times has to stop doing this. It's natural. Why? Eliphaz loves Job. So when Job is pouring out his heart, that must have been crushing. You want it to stop. How can you make it stop? Well, you got to turn off your heart.
right? Stop feeling it. Cut it off. How do we cut it off? Oh, just start judging. If I'm judging you, I'm back in my head. I'm away from my heart. I'm good. How else can I shut off my heart? Oh, I can give you advice. I'm analyzing the situation. Got this all logically kind of going, right? Oh, how do I shut off my heart? I can also use facts. Let's be like a lawyer in case build. This happened, and this, and this, and then you did that, and then, right? Heart's disconnected then. I don't have to feel anything from you. But I'm also not going to help you. And in fact, I'm going to make things a lot worse. Here's how bad it got. So, Job, right away, chapter 6, he spoke in 3, Eliphaz spoke in 4, 5. By chapter 6, he says, now you two have proved to be of no help. Took a week out of their life, they traveled, they sat with him in silence 7 days and 7 nights, felt it with him so much so that he descended to the depth of his heart, poured it out. All of it is forgotten because they massively judged, accused, and used facts. See how fast this can happen? Now, from here until Job 32. So from Job 4 to Job 32, what is that, 28 chapters? 28 long chapters. If any of you guys have looked at the book of Job, they don't have short chapters in Job. 28 chapters of the oldest recorded conflict in history. Why is God doing this? Oh, and what's worse? Each of the other two friends tried to do the same thing that Eliphaz did. All three of them did it. Why would God put 28 chapters of a conflict? What's he trying to say to us? I don't know about you, but I think one thing he's trying to say to us is pay attention. You need to connect. If you don't, things go south. If they go south, they stay south. So what I tell couples all the time is when they enter into a conflict together, they have two choices as to how this conflict is going to go. They have two choices as to how to approach the conflict. They can either fight to be right, or they can fight to be one. If they fight to be right, both of them are going to become like lawyers, case build, case build, case build, case build, case build. One of them is going to disagree with the facts because nobody perceives the same thing the same way, which is why eyewitness testimony to a crime scene always varies because we have different perceptions. And then inevitably you start arguing about the one fact that you both disagree with. So when you said X, Y, Z, of course I said A, B, C. I never said X, Y, Z. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, you didn't. Now the argument starts to case build from there. We get the next fact that we disagree with. So when you went over at Tommy's house at so-and-so time, I never went to Tommy's house at that time. I was at work. No, you weren't. You were out of work. Yes, I was. No, I wasn't. Yes. See how we can have like 5 arguments? Like most couples don't ever resolve the argument that they actually started with. They wind up somewhere different because we're constantly fighting to be right. We're trying to prove it. The whole idea when fighting to be right is there's just like this belief in the back of our heads. If only you would see it the way I do, we would not have this argument. But guess what? The other person's saying the same thing. If only you would see it the way I do, we wouldn't be having this argument. And now we go at it. Fighting to be one is completely different. Fighting to be one is I'm going to understand, listen to understand, I'm going to empathize, and I'm going to get your perception first. I'm going to see it the way you do. And say, here's how I'm hearing you see this. Am I right? Am I off? Have the person say yes. Can I share how I see it? Do the same process with the other person. So you're seeing this like this. Now we join each other together as one. What a concept of marriage, right? We're supposed to be one. So we join it, and now we attack the problem together. What are we going to do about it? So I have a whole workshop on that. I'm not going to do this now, but you get the idea. All right. So I'm really trying to say that most people are well-meaning when they judge, accuse, and call out facts. It's just most people aren't ready to hear it unless they're connected to. And so we've got to really avoid all of this. And so let me move us forward for the sake of time. And let's go into this. So in Job 32,
Elihu, it's the first time we hear of a fourth person, fourth friend being there, which is Elihu. So he must have showed up after, or I don't know if he was there before. It's the first time we're told about him. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use what he did as a base in order to show you guys how do you help somebody get to a core belief. So one thing that I want you to know, and I'm going to try to say this a little fast, is there's four ways that if you're trying to get to a core belief, the way to get to it is you have to understand how they're formed. If you can understand how they're formed, you know what questions to ask or what things to kind of draw out or to kind of get into that give you it. So the four major ways in which beliefs are formed, the first one is there is the spiritual component. So the world, the flesh, the devil, God, Jesus, the Holy Spirit, all of these things war for your beliefs. Whoever can get you to believe what they believe gets the rest of you. Because your emotions, your will, your reason, and your behaviors are going to follow that belief. So we got to pay attention to what's going on a spiritual level. Hence, praying is really important. Hence why we really want to kind of get their story of faith and all those other things. Family of origin. If we gather together the people you were raised with, it doesn't matter if some of them are preppy, others are punk. Doesn't matter if some are believers, some are not believers. If we ask four or five questions or so, we'll go through how to do this a little bit later. What we're going to find is that there's similar belief themes that run through the family. So one of the belief themes on my mother and my father only had me. My dad married after, had a wife and four kids. Because of the way my dad was traumatized by his poverty, and then he was raised in the South and went to Morehouse, then went to Meharry Medical, became an orthopedic surgeon who invented a lot of different things. And he lived in California. He invented a lot of different things. And then he also has worked with a lot of famous athletes. So he going from the traumatization of poverty to a lot of money, he's very paranoid about ever losing his money based on his trauma. And so one of the belief themes that runs in that family is that they never, ever lend anybody any amount of money. Because the basic belief theme is if you're after a little bit of money, you're trying to worm yourself in to get all the money. Therefore, you must be eliminated. So I have watched my dad eliminate his closest friends when they've asked him for even as little as a quarter to make a phone call. So it's an extreme version of it. What's interesting is my stepmother, my sister, and four brothers, they've never known poverty. So by the time they had kids, my dad was already really starting to make it. But yet, if you ask any of them for even a quarter, they'll nicely say no to you. But you won't know until later that you've been eliminated from their life. You never get a phone call. You never get invited. You never get anything. So that's on the extreme. Most of the times when we're helping people, it's a little more subtle than that, right? So major emotional traumatic events or times when you're rocked is another way in which beliefs form. So when you see, like, I don't know if any of you have ever seen somebody who came out of a car accident where they didn't have any physical injuries, but they were moving really slowly and they seemed like they were in real shock. Often that's a signal that of a major emotional trauma. What happens when we're traumatized is that there's an intense amount of emotions going through our bodies that our bodies just can't handle. So the brain releases a chemical to numb you out. So you just don't feel anything for a while. And then what winds up happening is it's like your heart, the factory of belief, says, I will never feel this kind of pain again. And so the heart sets up a new set of beliefs to try to protect you from ever being in a situation where you can go through that again. So an example from one of my clients is I had a client who was always notoriously late. She was late to work, 10 minutes late. She got into a car accident, really bad car accident, where she had no physical injuries, but she said a statement, an if-only statement. If any of the people you try to help have an if-only statement, pay attention to that, because that's often where the beliefs are going to change. Her belief statement was, if only I had been on time, I would not have been in this accident. True statement. Had she been on time, she would not have been in that accident. But we don't know what would have happened to her had she been on time. She could have been hit by a truck. She could have had a baby in a stroller. 10 million things that have happened that were worse than what she experienced. Nevertheless, this woman who was always notoriously late, she actually happened to be a therapist, and it's horrible when therapists are late. It's like counseling 101 is you show up every time on time. You know, that's like the first thing we learn. And she was she used to talk about being so late that her first two sessions would be waiting for her in the waiting room. So, yeah, not good. But she was brilliant at what she did, so people kind of put up with it. She suddenly, because of this accident, was always on time. She was always on time. Clients cheered, family cheered, everybody was so happy. But then it started going way, way, way too far. So she had therapists. We're known for keeping lots of clocks in the room in different locations depending on where a client sits. To be real with you, the reason why we have so many clocks is because we need to track time and not look sleazy about it. That's the real reason. So that's why we have them. So just picture you're in a session with her. She's great first 30 minutes. You love it. You're engaged. Everything. Doesn't matter where you are at the 30-minute mark. Doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a sentence. If you're crying, about to have an aha moment. Doesn't matter what's going on in your world. She would randomly just start to look at all the clocks in the room. First time she would do that, her clients say, hey, you know, if you need to get somewhere, we can stop this session early. We just tack on the time next time. And she would literally go, no, keep going. While she keeps track of time. If you blew past that a minute before the session was open, once again, doesn't matter if you're in the middle of a sentence, if you're crying, aha moment coming, doesn't matter what's going on in your world, she would literally stand up, walk over to the door of her office, open it all the way so anybody on the outside can see who's on the inside. Then she would stand at the door. At that point, if you did not move in 15 seconds, she was known to ramp up her anger to the point that she would cuss you out to leave. She would lose you as a client. Oftentimes, she said that the client who was waiting for her in the waiting room, they together would leave, so that client wouldn't want to have their session either, and she would hear them talking about her at the elevator. That wasn't what brought her into the office to get help for this. What brought her in was her husband, who said, because of this time issue, things have become so abusive in the house that my two sons, 6'3", 6'6", football players, are crying every single day because of the pressure to be on time. I can no longer tolerate the abuse. If this does not work, if this counseling does not work, I'm taking my sons and I'm separating. That's where we start. See how emotional traumatic events can change things? So while time isn't an issue, she's great. As soon as time becomes an issue, her emotions shift to anxiety. Then we see secondary emotions, rage, fear, whatever, disgust, annoyance. Then we start seeing behaviors. Compulsively look at clocks, kind of ahaying everybody, standing by the door, cussing out clients. Just when a belief gets triggered. Another way that your beliefs are formed is through milestones or huge successes. So if you've ever fought for something and it worked, it succeeded, often then new beliefs are formed to the positive. So just four things to kind of look out for. So we'll talk about more next time. Let me just track time. Yep, I've got to get to the story. I'll do this section next. And then let's talk about my story. So what I want to do, and some of you guys who are in the men's group heard this story, so I'm going to repeat it. And I'm going to tell you what was one of the most traumatic events that ever happened in my life. And I want you to assume that we're in church together or something like that. Maybe I'm a part of your cog, right? And for whatever reason, I'm choosing to talk to you about what happened. Okay? And what I want you to listen for and what I want you to pay attention to is I want you, as you're listening to me, I don't want you to try to fix me. Don't try to reply. Don't say, oh, Ryan, if only you knew X, you would be all better now. Don't do that. What I want you to do is I want you to stay with me, and I want you to track, what are you feeling as you're hearing my story? What do you sense I was going through when the experience happened? Just track some very basic things. What are you hearing me repeat a lot? What's really going on at the heart of things for me? Now, to be clear, I have fully forgiven the person that I'm going to talk about. So there isn't an issue of forgiveness left for me. Fully forgiven. And I've got to be clear also, sometimes when I tell my story, those people who are in the audience have not fully forgiven who did this to me. Sometimes they feel kind of angry at the person. but I need to do this because if we're really going to help people, you need to be able to go through some of the emotions that you're going to feel, kind of as you describe, feeling that pull towards something you've never felt before and be able to manage it. And I also want to do this with you because I want to leave enough room for us to kind of zip up after I share this and be able to kind of process it. Now, just to warn you, sometimes I cry when I tell my story. It's not because it's still raw. It's because it's really sad. It was hard. And I might cry for one of your stories. It would feel more like that to me as opposed to ripping open a wound kind of thing. Does that make sense? I'm also going to turn off the recorder because this story is a little intense.